children were also contemporaries of ours, and Sharon, I believe, is deceased, but I've run across David through Facebook in recent times, and probably could connect with him and ask that question. But I would say, another one, Louis Kwasnikov is still alive and of mentally sound, lives in Nilchik, and he might be a good person to ask of something like that. I would guess that there probably would be some evidences maybe near where this first schoolhouse was in this area. In terms of other things, you could probably turn up evidence of somebody's ash pile. They burn coal, and the coal has a lot of ashes. They pick up coal along the beach, and then you take the ashes out and often would dump them in an ash pile. And sometimes you'd use the ashes to spread if it's slippery or icy. So often there'd be an ash pile, and there'd probably be evidences of that, and maybe evidences of where you'd bury bones or things like that, because, they get moose, and I don't know often if they leave the bones out by the moose and then just bring the meat home, but there probably would be evidences of that. I don't know how much people buried their waste. Of course, didn't have paper, cardboard, wood waste like we have today. Now 80%+ of what we throw out is going to be paper, plastic, newspaper, that type of waste, and that didn't exist so much then. And so less waste products, but there probably could be some evidences of finding, maybe some buried steel cans, or, they call tin cans, but, tin-coated steel and other things like that.
Were beads ever found? Have beads ever turned up here?
I don't know, but I do know, and I've seen at the museum at UAF, there's a very nice collection, and there are some things from the Nanilchik area. So if you really want to look at it, I would say get the gal, I'm not coming up with the name, but anyway, the curator or whoever's is running that at UAF,
okay.
And there is a collection of things like knives or just implements that had been found in the Nanilchik area.
Stone tools.
Some evidences, and that would have been pre-Russian.
Right. And when Frederica de Laguna came here in the 30s, she didn't actually go to Nanilchik, as near as I can tell, but she was told about a stone lamp that was found there, which would be even pre-Athabascan. That would probably be a older than 1,000-year Eskimo kind of artifact. And it was attributed to Nanilchik. So.
Mm. Yeah, so I know they're like arrowheads and a few things like that have been attributed to being found in Nanilchik. There may be some things from the Russian era that are part of that university collection.
Mm-hmm.
Before it slips my mind, I want to just mention that when we were growing up, we found some of what we were told were barabaras on the hillside, right on here. This is the part that slopes down into the village. And we may have found something farther up along in here. But anyway, at any rate, there were these depressions in the earth that appeared to have been dug by humans, and then there was overgrowth, and there were still some of these depression areas.
And so, for the tapes, that would be on the north corner of the bluff of the river.
Yeah, that would be on the bluff. The David and Wanda Cooper had a house here, and then there was I guess it's right here. The old Iskolkov house was right here, but sort of on this hillside back, just above the store.
And you say they were actually on the slope?
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we found several of those. Haven't been there. I think the overgrowth and erosion probably would mask them a lot more now today than what we saw. But we saw some of those evidences that, you know, we were told, oh, those were Barabras. So mm-hmm. might have been.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when the old school used to be up here still?
I do. There were two schools up here, but the one I remember and have pictures of, and actually would go in and explore in it. It was a nice structure. Unfortunately, some mischievous, probably kids, broke out all the windows, and so there was a lot of glass strewn in there. But it had a very nice hardwood floor, and it was right here, just to the west of the Russian Orthodox Church, and that building was taken down and used to rebuild the Palmer House out in Deep Creek Road. They had a catastrophic fire, lost their home, and as Nenilchik, you know, steps up, and everybody joined together, volunteered, and they got lumber from this school and helped rebuild that home. That I'm happy that they were able to have a home. I'm not so happy that that was chosen as the source of lumber, because that would have been a very good historic structure to have sort of kept in memory in the Nilchik, and I wish that that hadn't been done. And right next to it, just a little bit closer to our home as you go to the north, there still is a concrete foundation. A school had been built there, and shortly after it opened, it burned. And there was not only the concrete foundation that was there, but there was a very substantial concrete, I guess I'd call it chimney. It was probably for whatever the heating system was in the school, and that had fallen over and was within this sort of foundation structure. And my dad would point it out to us. He said, well, that's the old school that burned. And so all I remember from that was that, you know, there's that was in the ground. And as far as I know, that's still there today. I'm not aware of anybody actually taking that out.
Okay.
Yep, there's the school that I remember.
In this UAF photo.
Mm-hmm.
I have a photo here, which is taken looking southwest, and so it's got the creek in it, and this building is still there. This frame building with the gables facing the inlet and the shed roof addition on the north side, this building is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that,
mm-hmm.
What was that?
I think that's the building that was a dance hall, and then there's a post office in there that my Uncle Harry, Harry Lehman, was the postmaster of for a while. And in addition, I mean, it must have been something other than a dance hall, and it was something else as well. I don't know if that was Juanita Anderson's place or if hers was just to the north of here. But
is this the Juanita Anderson that lived in Soldovia? Was a school teacher?
Yeah, she's a school teacher.
Okay.
And she was a teacher here in the Nilchik, but she also was a part owner in, or she may have started something of seafood processing facility on this side, and Newt Armstrong had one on that side. Probably my Uncle Joe could tell a little bit more of the history, or even Juanita, if she'd be willing to participate, my Aunt Juanita, and tell you a little bit more about this. But that's what I remember. And then in later years, when I was a young teenager, the Waldo Bishop family, and he married Ruby Heatherton, and their family stayed in this house right across from the Kwasnikoff house. So that was in later years. And then this house
immediately to the south.
Yeah, immediately to the south. I believe at one time my great grandmother stayed in that house, but I remember Charlie Cooper and his family staying in there for a while. But this could have been a house for Elizabeth Kwasnikoff Cooper. And that would be my great grandmother.
How do you spell Kwasnikoff?
KVASNIKOFF. Okay. And in the Nilchik, locals call it Kwasnikoff. But if you go to Nanwalik, and that's where Sergei Kwasnikoff, who was from the Nanilchik area, moved and intermarried, and they've since grown up. They call it Kvasnikoff, which is more correct in terms of how it's said in Russia. And so what happened in Nanilchik, it was, you know, how language changes, or somebody changes names, and people got used to that, and so they've called it Kwasnikoff in Nanilchik, but Kvasnikoff in Nanwalik, and of course, you go to Russia, it would be Kvasnikoff today. K-V-A-S, Kvas. Kvas is actually a drink in Russian. It's, you know, it's a little bit of a, has a little bit of a nip to it.
Right to the north of the dance hall, we'll call it. Is that what people would call this?
Well, there was a dance hall in it. There may have been other things in there, but it was a big enough structure, and they had a cleared area, so they did. I thought my dad, I know, played his guitar there at the dance hall in the, you know, probably early 40s or maybe even late 30s. Late 30s, he would have been about 20 years old, so that's probably about right. I think he played in there. Many of the locals had musical talent. And so they would have dances and get-togethers, and it was quite a community event.
So to the north of that is this log cabin.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about that?
I don't know very much about it at all, other than it's been there a long time. I drive by it when I go through here and take my trucks to the beach. I know it's an old structure, but that may have been part of that Juanita Anderson, originally part of her operation. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm. And there may be better sources than you for this too, but the store history, to the east, this is a log cabin, and to the west, that's a two-story frame building there. What do you know anything about the history of that building? Was there always a store in there?
During my life, I always remember this as being a store. In my youngest years, we would shop there. I mean, it was, you know, as stores go today, you would think it wasn't well equipped. But there were canned goods. There was very modest supply of things like fruit, maybe apples or something like that occasionally, and there would be flour, sugar, and then in later years there'd be a little bit of frozen product or refrigerated product, maybe some milk. But my mother would, when we were old enough to walk down there, of course before we were old enough we'd walk with her, but we were old enough, she would write down on a list what she wanted us to get, and she would say, can you go down to the store? And we would, in our earliest years, we would just take it and hand it to Irene Kraskoff, and she would read it, and she would go, No! She'd smack her gums because she would have had false teeth, and she'd go, and what does the mama want today? And, okay, and she would go to the shelves and get things and then give them to us, and we'd go home, and she would put the purchase on a list and just sort of keep a running tab, and then every so often she would say, and Lauren, you tell the papa it's time to pay the bill. And so it got to a certain level, and he would come in and pay her. But I always remember this store as being here, and the what presumably is the older log area was the living quarters, and then the store was in this area, and then there was behind it sort of a, I don't know if they call it a warehouse, but sort of a storage area probably for product that they would then bring out and put on the shelves.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk about this project that's coming up, which you, I'm not sure how much you're involved in the scoping for it, but a new, and for the benefit of the tape, the reason I'm doing this is part of a project for a new water line through the old village, and then the plan is to put 21 individual septic systems to serve the 21 individual households here. And the proposed water line is going to be coming down more or less along the existing road. And my job is to, first of all, do the investigation to put together an archaeological testing plan, and then do the testing ahead of all the trenching and excavation and stuff that's going to come along with the sewer project and the septic tanks and that. So what I'm attempting to do here is to come up with some, from the archival and oral history, to come up with some predictions about what we may find along here and what it might mean kind of ahead of time, you know. And it looks to me like the road into here is pretty, a pretty low level of engineering, and there's not much of a ditch on either side, and it, more than anything, it looks like people just came in and dumped gravel over the top of whatever is there, rather than have much of a prepared surface. I don't know if that's the case or not, but what would you expect we might find if and when the road gets trenched through here? And so the second question will be, you know, 21 individual holes in people's backyards, which may or may not have had any kind of buildings or activity on them for all the way back to the Russian times, conceivably. Does that present you with any sort of picture about what we may find, or you know, sensitive areas, in your opinion, would be off to the west here, where the old part dance hall, etc., was, because that's a logical place for the original buildings, as is the old Russian Orthodox school site, which is a logical place for some of the older buildings. But it's easy for me to imagine, given how many families were packed in here, that everything in between could have had buildings of various types into the late 1800s and that also. And does this, you have any feel for that? Any of that?
Well, probably the areas of greatest impact would be those that are in on the highest available ground in the village itself. And so when you look at it, there's no small wonder why this area closer to Nanilchik River hasn't been developed, because it's the area most susceptible to flooding. And it was, of course, back in 1847, as well as today. And so people would then build on the higher areas so they can be above the flooding. And I think you're probably right. You know, it's like the Alaska Highway. When you built it, you sort of just ran the bulldozer down, and now today you wonder, well, why would there be so many curves? Well, that's just how it was it was built, and it was done quickly. In this particular case, the road came through here. There probably was an established trail. It would sort of make sense that this would sort of be coming down through the community. And so as that became a natural pathway, then as others came in, either with tractors or vehicles, and it became used more, probably start building up. And then when the Alaska Road Commission in territorial days did its work and then just kept building, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you'll find, as you say, that there's, there's a lot of gravel in here, and if you were to go down and trench through it, you probably not find geotextile, probably not find that the road prism has actually been built up from a substantial excavation where you normally would excavate out bad material and replace it with good structural material. I'm unaware of that. I believe that there have been improvements through here. I know there certainly was around the bridge, and and after the flooding of whatever that was within the last 10 years or so, where there's substantial flooding, there's a lot of rock work done along in here. So there were improvements here, and I know that there have been improvements through here, or at least maintenance type things. The borough has done some, but I would be quite surprised to see from this area on into the community if that really is what I would call real good structural fill. And so it probably has just been built up, and material added when there were potholes, and that'd be a kind of a typical roadway. It's actually fairly in, it's a lot of potholes and things like that right now, but it's fairly good condition. It's not in the spring, it doesn't rut, it's not like big soft holes, and so when I look at it as well, it's fairly decent.
Yeah, I thought
what,
so too.
Yeah, what might be found is the plan to actually dig in the roadway and to put the water line in the roadway, or be it adjacent to the roadway?
A little bit of both, depends.
If it isn't, you're going to be crossing the roadway, of course.
No, it's mostly parallel, but you know how these heirloom systems are. There's going to be surprises in the cracks.
Yeah, yeah. And would there be things found? I'd say probably, but probably not so deep. I'm not aware, although I wouldn't be surprised if there are some graves down in the village itself. I'm not aware of where they are, if there are any. But I would say be on the lookout for things like that. I would.
Well, let me question that, because given the Russian Orthodoxy, doesn't that kind of promote burial only in the graveyard, or does that make more? Is there an exclusivity? In other words, are there going to be people who were not allowed to be buried in the Russian Orthodox graveyard that were categorically excluded because of their beliefs? It just seems to me, I wouldn't have expected historic graves down here, because we've already, probably from the very early times, have a designated graveyard up there.
Yeah, well, this church wasn't built till the early 1900s, but it's true that there would have been established some area of burial, and the Russian Orthodox had a tradition of where this would be. I mean, first of all, there would be burial of the body. It was one where cremation wasn't practiced, and even today is often based on, maybe a deep cultural belief system that probably not be the preferred method for disposal of remains. as his, you know, burial of a body. And so the traditional burial spot has been surrounding the church. And you're right that it was those who had a connection with the Russian Orthodox Church would then be able to be buried within the what's now the fenced area. And as more people moved into the community, say they came as homesteaders, you know, in the 40s, people would come, and some of those people made Ninilchik home. Many of them made Ninilchik home, and some of them died, and many of them were not members of the Russian Orthodox Church. So the question then came about: what do you do with them? And that's when what is now the American Legion cemetery adjacent to the Russian Orthodox graveyard came into being, and you know that. So outside the fence is an area where many people that are part of the community are buried today. I am not aware of there being any grave sites down in the village itself. Mm-hmm. I'm just, when I mention it, you know, I don't know in the earliest days if this had been established as an area of burial or somewhere else, but we know from looking at history, and all we have to do is look at Agrippina's children, we know that some of the people died probably as early as the late 1840s, certainly in the 1850s. And so there were people who died. There were children who died young. They would get a disease and would die young. And they would be buried someplace.
Right.
And almost assuredly, it wouldn't be a fully lined steel box that would last through time. It more likely would be, a wood structure that probably is decomposed, and so the evidence of burial would be a little bit different now. And it's possible that we could come across some of those, but I would say less likely in what I would say the mainline excavation of the project. More likely, if it does occur, in providing the service connections to homes. If something like that were to be discovered, it would be more likely as you get closer to the homes. It's possible somebody might have buried a loved one near their home, but in the Russian Orthodox tradition, it was done in an area near the church and to the I don't remember where the first church may have been down here, but I'll
there.
This was first church,
yes.
The one that became the Jakinski. Okay, so
is that the Jakinski home there?
Yeah. Well, that's a rebuild of it. The Jakinski home was taken apart log by log and relocated someplace. So I think this picture right here, while it's on or near that property, is. I don't think this is that actual structure.
I think it's new.
Yeah. But if this is the church, in the earliest days, I guess it is possible that there may have been graves here.
Yeah.
I don't know if they had established a burial spot up the hill. It's quite possible that they just said, okay, this is where we live. We're going to have a burial spot somewhat distant from where we are. They're smart people. They recognize the potential for transmission of disease and also to be respectful of the deceased. And so it's quite possible that that a burial spot was established even before the church was built. I don't know. My Uncle Joe may be able to tell you about that, or Simeon Oskolkov, well, he's younger than Uncle Joe by 10 or 12 years. He was a longtime Russian Orthodox priest, and he was a student of of Russian Orthodoxy in Alaska. In particular, he served this community as well as others. And he lives in Anchorage. Okay. And is available. His mind is good, as far as I know. You know, he calls me from time to time. Not often, but from time to time. And he's an intelligent man who may be able to go back, let's say at 20 years farther than I lived, and then plus maybe understand that history a little bit more from his family's side, because his father was involved in the church as a reader or something, and so, you know, his involvement in Russian Orthodoxy and understanding some of the traditions, what they might have done, is stronger than mine.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to make sure we discuss before I leave are your sort of a summary of your suggestions for additional people to talk to. But we might best do that off tape, perhaps. So while we're still on tape, is there any kind of concluding thoughts that you might have about my mission in this project and what I'm facing and, you know, historical information I would be well advised to collect, or any particular concerns that you might have about this project, or, you know, before we sign off here, this is your last chance, so...
Well, I think you're on the right track. You've actually unearthed some things, and looking back, I think I have seen some of this survey information years ago, but I didn't have it at my fingertips. And there's a lot of good collected information on the history of Nanilchik and its families in Agrafena's Children, which actually collected from a number of other sources. That particular project started from some information that Semyon Oskolkov had shared with me about our family ancestry that went back to presumably a marriage in Kodiak between Yefim Rastroguyev and Agrafena, who was from Afognak. And when I had that lineage, I shared that with my brother Wayne, who took that project and exploded it into, a substantially more advanced project. And then when he printed that book, you know, he had to cut it off at some point and say, okay, we're going to publish. It's amazing how many people came forward and said, oh, if I knew you were serious about doing this project, I would have shared this story or this information. And he said, well, that could be volume two, or we can, you know, do a second version, a revised version. And he started on that, but it was just too big of a project for where he was at that time. He's a linguist, and he was just too engaged in translation work to carry that project on through. He said, he offered it to others, and he said, you know, what I have, if you want to take it, fine. Otherwise, it may have to wait until so-called retirement, or, you know, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. But and he would still like to, you know, to take it on and do it. But of course, time's marching on, and I don't remember the date, but I think this book came out almost 20 years ago, and so many of the people who were alive when this book came out are no longer alive, and obviously in 20 years there's a whole bunch more people who have been born. 93 is when this book came out, and you have access to it or have seen
it. In the library, yeah.
Okay, I see in here, and I don't know how much value this might be, but here's some notes from my talking with my dad. It was called North Coast Packing Company. Newt Armstrong, that's K-N-U-T-E, was the manager. Was started in 1925, and Joe Lehman, that'd be my Uncle Joe, and Mike Rissoff fish for them. 1927 to 31. That means the Joe Lima would have been my grandfather, not my Uncle Joe. That would be my grandfather, Joe Lehman. And, this an aside Dad said. Mike Rissoff made good sourdough pancakes with seagull eggs. And if they floated, that would be if the eggs floated, they were no good. Because they were ready to hatch. And he said, Nick Lehman and Bob Rissoff, that would be his cousin Bob, who became a very substantial businessman in Alaska. He's now deceased, but they were contemporaries and cousins. Ran from the beach net with bare feet to the cannery. Their beach net would be up here, some 2 miles along the beach to the cannery, right here, to tell them to come to pick up the fish at the trap, I guess when they were kids. And then this is pretty interesting. I had forgotten about this. My grandfather, Joe Lehman, fished at Highland, which is it's south of the Kasilof River. There's a Humpy Point, and then there's an area. If you look at the bluff south of Humpy Point, it's called Highland. So the bluff is higher, and then it gets down to the Clam Gulch area. And my dad said he was scared to go to bed in the tent, which they had down there at the fish trap, because of porcupines walking on the beach. And Joe, that would be my grandfather, took my dad in the skiff and rowed with oars all the way because they didn't have any outboard motors. Talk about being in good shape. Wow. And this one's funny. The captain of the Westward, that would be Gene Mason, who would operate for Cook Inlet Packing Company out of Saldovia, stopped in Inilchik one night and visited my dad's step-grandfather. I talked about Elizabeth Kwasnikoff Cooper, who was my great-grandmother, and she was, pointed out this house over here where she lived. Well, she was widowed when Joe Cooper, who is the Joe Cooper of Cooper Landing, died in 1899, and she was still a reasonably young woman. She was born in 1867 or 1865, somewhere around there, so that would have made her about 32 years old. She was still a young woman. She remarried later a man named Steve Churkin, who was from Russia. But anyway, Gene Mason stopped and visited his step-grandfather, Steve Churkin, and, as Dad said, ransacked his strawberry patch with a flashlight. And the next day, the strawberries were gone. So anyway, Gene Mason enjoyed the strawberries. So who knows? There's probably strawberry patches we have to be careful of. But that would have been somewhere down in here. All kinds of stories of Ninilchik that are pretty interesting. Some of the people I remember a woman, we called her Babushka. She was Matrona Askalkov, and she was probably in her young 80s, but she was old as dirt, and my grandmother would go visit her. In this, there was a little house right here. This little house here, and I remember it. And
it's just across from the old
church. Yeah. There's an old cabin right here. I don't even know if it's still standing today, but she was here. I remember she was in bed, and her last either days or weeks or months of life. And my grandmother took me to visit her, and she's buried up here, and so also is my grandmother. I remember her. We called her Babushka, and then she had a son, Alec Askalkov. We call him Kasaman. His name was Kasaman, but I remember him. He was quite a guy. He would walk through the village, and always he was very friendly. We'd stop and visit with him and talk. He was a very nice man. But there was just a lot of history of these old timers that we've lost because so many of them are gone. But if we can, if we can maintain that memory through either some documentation, either in oral records or books or pictures, some way, then people can understand a little bit more of their heritage. Those who are, similar ancestry to me, and others like you who are interested in it can learn about it. And so, getting this documented is a good thing.
Well, thank you for helping.
You're welcome.
To conclude, it occurs to me, I've heard you mimic your father's voice because you said Russian was his first language.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could, just to conclude the tape, relate any favorite sayings that he had. Are there any particular, when you think of your dad, are there any particular comments or sayings that are, exclamations that he would, liked in particular?
Oh, there were lots of them, and will I remember them all now? Probably not, but one expression, not unique to him, but to several in the community, ay-yi-yi. Ay-yi-yi, it means, essentially we say, oh my, what? Why has that happened? But it was an expression like that. And another one, and he's told the story of Stupai. In Russian, stupat, I think it's stupat or stupit, stupat means to go away. Stupai would be like the imperative, you go away. And there was a man who was working, in the vicinity of Ninilchik. I don't know if he's mining along the beach, and somebody said, hey, if you go up there to that village, they're real friendly people, and, they'll invite you in, have a cup of tea and maybe a piece of pie or something to eat, and you get a chance to visit with them. So he took him at his word and went, came to a door, and the woman comes out, and he said, tried to talk to her and said, well, he's in the area, and he heard that, they would invite him in. She looks at him and said, Stupai. And he goes, oh, yeah, that sounds pretty good. Sure, stupai, sure, any kind of pie. And she goes, no, stupai, stupai. And he goes, any kind of pie. And so she went back in and got a broom and started waving at him. And he understood, she doesn't want me here. Well, she was telling him, go away. And my dad, as my dad tells the story, and Uncle Joe, And so that was one of those plays on language. Another expression that he would often use is, I'm the boss, you're Sobachi Host. Well, Sobachi Host means the dog's tail. And if I say this one to somebody who understands Russian, they laugh immediately, and they understand it. The dog's tail is the one that's wagging behind. You're the boss, I'm Sobachi Host. Well, it's a play on sort of a play on language. And Dad would often do that. His first language was Russian. When they went to school, his command of English was modest, as it was for many of the children. But the teachers who were sent as part of the territorial school system didn't understand Russian. And I think they were a little bit intimidated. And instead of learning that language, they said, we're going to speak English, I'm going to teach you English, and that's all I want you to speak. And if I hear you speaking Russian, I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap. And so they sort of got this impression that their Russian was an inferior language. And even though on the playground and behind the teacher, they of course still talk Russian and perhaps say things about the teacher, and as kids will be kids. But many, like my father, and even maybe as young as 20 years younger than him, not much younger than that, learned and used Russian a fair amount. And there is a poem that my father does repeat, and even today, even in his limited capacity, he remembers this poem and he says it often. But he said there was a, I think it was Grichka, or I'm not sure, it was one of the, maybe a Skolkovs, came to when my Uncle Harry was born, and he was a little baby in a crib. And he said to him, Haritashka Skaritashka, Selkorovu Ibika, Siamsat Parasyat Adalapachki Vosyat. And then he laughs, and today he laughs. And it essentially means, Harry, little Harry, you know, little darling Harry, ate 700 bulls and cows, and all that was left, or something was left, was like the skins or something hanging. And it's kind of nonsense, but often that is the case when you have language and a few things like that. It's kind of these nursery ditties, but Dad would often say that, and he says it today. There often would be either plays on words or a mixing of English and their Russian words, and then there would be some words that do not obviously derive from Russian, or the Russian language has changed over time, and the Russian spoken in Inilchik was sort of, it's a blast from the past. In fact, Russian linguists today study the Inilchik Russian and Kenai Russian,